Hello, everyone. Welcome to our weekly Course in Miracles study group. I am so grateful, as always, that you all are here and joined in a shared purpose, ready to help strengthen these loving ideas in our minds for one another. So let's begin, as we always do, with taking a few minutes to join in silent meditation, although I might, as usual, feel prompted to just share a few thoughts. Let's just begin with taking a few deep breaths. And I've been learning so much about the need to just be embodied, to be able to ground. And taking a few mindful deep breaths as we settle in. And let's collectively just imagine all of us together on this call in a big circle. And with the support of each other, with the support of Holy Spirit, releasing everything, withholding nothing, handing it all over to the Holy Spirit. And if there's hesitation or fear that arises, just notice that and see if you can be willing to hand that over too. In my experience, handing everything over means that you give the opportunity for the Holy Spirit to repurpose everything. And so whatever continues to arise in our awareness comes up for healing. As the Course says, we need be anxious over nothing. And if you feel yourself holding on to something that you don't want to hand over to the Holy Spirit, remembering how supported you are, and how everything is safely repurposed in the Holy Spirit's loving arms. I'm just resting in this space for a few breaths. This holy instant we give to you. Be you in charge, for we would follow you. Certain that your direction gives us peace. If we need a word, a thought, or a tranquil open mind, these are the gifts that Holy Spirit gives. And we gladly and joyously place Holy Spirit in charge tonight, holding on to nothing. With the love in your heart and light in your mind, coming together to our perception of right here, right now. Welcome, everyone. A few more folks have joined since we started recording. I'm grateful you all are here. Tonight, we are reading Cameo 28. It's called The Blue-Gray Bird. It's about a dream that Helen had. It's on the longer side, so we're going to be doing a little bit more reading tonight, maybe than usual, a few extra pages, but we'll get through it all, and it's a very interesting symbolic dream. Alrighty. Let's dive in. Cameo 28, The Blue-Gray Bird. So this is I don't want to say it's lengthy, but it's a good almost two pages of a story. And I want to just read the whole thing just so we get the whole story in one reading. The Blue-Gray Bird. In the text section above the battleground, we find a clear reference to a dream Helen had years before the course. This reference joins together the section and the dream so that each one adds to the other. The dream was one she had in 1940 when she was 31 years old. She titled it The Blue-Gray Bird and told it in the form of a story. The story begins with a line. This story begins with a line. Once upon a time, there was a blue bird, which is only partially true. It would be more accurate to say, once upon a time, there was a bird who told everybody that he was a bluebird. In point of fact, he was gray. Since this was perfectly obvious, people got the impression that the bird was somewhat confused, but this was not the case at all. It seems that the bird lived at the time of the American Civil War, which was often called the war between the blues and the grays. The bird was inclined to be rather peaceful himself, and he found the war quite disturbing. He was especially concerned about the final outcome, but he had no way of predicting which side would win. And so he felt it would be safest to prepare for either eventuality. Being a gray bird, he reasoned, was the best thing to do. Being a gray bird, he reasoned, the best thing to do is to adopt the position of being blue. Then, if the grays win, they will say, this bird is gray, even though he insists that he is blue. As long as he is really gray, what difference does it make that what he thinks he is? We will not hurt him. On the other hand, if the blues win, they will say, this gray bird evidently believes that he is blue. As long as he thinks this, what difference does it make what he really is? We will not hurt him. This position was somewhat difficult to maintain consistently over time, but it was not in itself an impossible one. But unfortunately, a number of complicating circumstances arose, which made it increasingly untenable. In the first place, even though it might be useful in a future peace, it was of no service at all during the actual war, being actually quite irrelevant. Meanwhile, the bird was living in a dry and rotting tree, entirely leafless from endless battles. The branches were broken, the roots were shriveled, and the trunk was tilting perilously. It was, however, the only tree left standing after so many years of war, so the bird did not know where else to go. In order to maintain his equilibrium in the tree, the bird was compelled to lean increasingly in the opposite direction to compensate for the sagging of the branches. As time went on, he became quite lopsided, so much so that he would no longer have been able to keep his balance in a straight tree, even if he ever managed to find one. This, however, did not concern him too much, since the chances of his finding a straight tree anymore were rather remote. What really bothered him were certain contradictory elements in the whole situation, which he found very difficult to reconcile. He recognized that when a bird is in difficulty, it flies away. Yet here was a bird who, in spite of very difficult living conditions, had not only failed to fly away, but had not even tried to do so. Being fairly rational as birds go, he could not escape the uncomfortable feeling that despite being depressing, the situation was also slightly ridiculous. It was possible, he thought, that this obvious discrepancy in his bird behavior was due to the fact that he was unable to fly. But this, he felt, was not likely in a bird. Another possibility which occurred to him, and one which frightened him very badly, was that he was not really a bird at all. This, of course, would account for his not flying away. But it would also mean that nobody could seriously regard his basic problem as primarily a difficulty in color perception, which would leave him as poorly equipped to deal with peace as with war. Perhaps, fortunately, under the circumstances, he had to admit, as a practical bird, that managing to live through war was probably the most he could handle. Armies from both sides kept appearing from nowhere and smashing at each other under the tree. The blood-drenched ground shook under them, and the noise was ear-splitting. They were probably unaware of the bird in his tree, but the effects on both were devastating. Knowing that the tree could not possibly last much longer, it was probably pointless to worry about what would become of him in a hypothetical peace. And that's Helen's story. Interesting dream, right? Must have been, I wonder how she felt waking up from that. So let's continue reading here. Helen is famous for being deeply torn between her spiritual nature and her earthly identity. And this dream captures that inner split with an almost, how do you say that? I don't know how to say that, absurdity. The bird in the dream is hopelessly divided. He is not only committed to being both a bluebird and a gray bird, he is committed to staying on a field of battle between the blues and the grays. This commitment makes literally no sense. It makes his life both miserable and precarious when, being a bird, he could easily fly away and escape the whole thing. His allegiance to the split, in other words, is quite insane. I want to just underline that. His allegiance to the split, in other words, is quite insane. This dream captured Helen's mindset so aptly that Jesus refers to it in this passage early in the dictation of the course in late 1965. And this is the version from the notes. Jesus says, "The confusion of miracle impulse with sexual impulse is a major source of perceptual distortion because it induces rather than straightens out the basic level confusion which underlies all those who seek happiness with instruments of the world. A desert is a desert is a desert. You can do anything you want in it, but you cannot change it from what it is. It still lacks water, which is why it is a desert. The thing to do with a desert is to leave." On the face of it, this passage may not seem to be a reference to that dream. But in the Ur text, Jesus inserts this parenthetical remark right before the final sentence. "Bring up that dream about the bluebird." Once he says this, you can understand why he does. Here he is talking about how Helen is attached to both miracle impulses, the impulse to extend love to another's mind, and sexual impulses, the impulse to extend lust to another's body, to the point of actually confusing the two. He says that by seeking happiness with the instruments of the world, i.e. bodies, she ties herself to the world. Yet on a mental, emotional level, the world is a desert, a place that is inhospitable to life. Rather than remaining tied to this desert, the thing to do is to leave. I'm going to read just a little bit more and we'll pause. All of these themes can be seen reflected in the blue-gray bird, a figure symbolizing Helen being torn between two opposing sides, which then ties her to a hostile environment, which she instead should just leave. By bringing in her dream from 25 years before, Jesus shows that what he's teaching her is not some bizarre new concept. It's a message that has been knocking on her door for decades. Indeed, after telling her to look up the dream, he makes that very point. Note that the essential content hasn't changed. This brief reference to the blue-gray bird closely foreshadows what we see in Above the Battleground, which was dictated in 1967. In this text section, there is no overt reference to the dream, but the imagery is such a specific match that the connection is instantly recognizable. So listen to this. This is from a paragraph from the course. "To be released from conflict means that it is over. The door is open. You have left the battleground. You have not lingered there in cowering hope that the battle will not return because the guns are still an instant and the fear that haunts the place of death is not apparent. There is no safety, excuse me, there is no place of safety in a battleground. You can look down on it safely from above and not be touched, but from within it, you can find no safety. Not one tree left standing still will shelter you. Just as in The Blue-Gray Bird, we have Helen lingering on a battleground, ravaged by repeated battles, pathetically hoping to find shelter in the one tree left standing. Her account of the dream says the only tree left standing, when she instead should rise above it where the war cannot touch her. So Jesus is clearly bringing her dream into this section. By doing so, he effects a kind of fusion of both the dream and the section. The dream lends its vivid imagery to the section, and the section applies its sophisticated teaching to the dream. Out of the coming together of both, then, something new is produced. A particularly important message emerges for Helen's life, one that we'll try to elucidate now. And I'm going to pause here. We'll start with that in just a moment. So this is quite an interesting symbolic dream about the battleground. And I just have to share really quick, just as a side story, because it's just coming up for me so strongly, and I'm going to just make it quick. But last summer, I was having some very, very intense, and maybe I'll do a podcast about this someday. I don't think I'm ready to just yet, but there's a park near my house where one of the biggest and bloodiest battles of the Revolutionary War. It's called Monmouth Battlefield State Park. And there are houses still standing that saw the crossfire of the British and the Loyalists and British and the rebels. And that house is still standing. And when I'm reading this, it was a house that was actually in the crossfire. Just the interesting parallel to me with this dream and that location, because I was having very unexplainable experiences in that park, kind of being like a bit obsessed with it and feeling that having feelings that I was home again, that I hadn't, I shouldn't digress too much because I'm still actually processing through it, but it was a sense of something from either a past life or some forgotten memory. And somehow, I do know that there were slaves that lived in the houses that still stand. Somehow it's always deeply, deeply felt to me that it had to do with what is happening with the loved ones, with that being birthed. Total side story and digression. So thank you for just letting me share that. But maybe, one day I'll share a bit more. But what stands out to me are just all these messages of how, it's about rising above the battleground. There's no peace within the battle. Wherever we are torn, this reminds me of how Nook Sanchez, and I always love this image, that if you have one foot in one canoe and one foot in another canoe, and one canoe represents the ego and the other canoe represents the Holy Spirit, that's not very stable ground to stand on. And that's essentially what we're doing, because our allegiance is divided. We want the Holy Spirit and we want peace, and yet we still want this. We are still invested in our bodies, in our identities, in the world, in whatever. And so what I gain from this reading thus far is just a reminder for myself that Although like intellectually understanding that I need to leave the battleground is what is the truth, that I can't get there just through thinking that. In my experience and what I'm learning is that it's by going through our lessons and really listening to guidance and being led through that, that's when we can start to have those experiences that actually show us that this world is not our home, and have an experience of being lifted above the battleground. It's not, from our intellect, it's an experience that comes through being fully where we are. So I think that's all I want to say so far. Anybody have any comments or questions or just reflections on what we've read so far? And thank you for letting me just share about the my park obsession. I often wonder if one day it'll come out more so in a podcast, because there's kind of a lot to it. But thoughts or a reflection so far? Any questions? How do we say that word I couldn't pronounce? Kafkaesque? Something?
Kafkaesque.
Kafkaesque, thank you. When I read this earlier, I didn't even notice that it was there, or I would have looked it up. Thank you, Andrea.
It's meaning that it's like a work by Kafka, the author.
Got it. Thank you so much. All right, we ready to keep reading? Jason.
Was he the author? Maybe somebody knows this. Kafka was, I spent some time in Prague 20 years ago. And was he the one that wrote that fiction about waking up and being a cockroach?
Andrea's saying yes.
Yes? Okay.
I have no comments. So I have no idea. That sounds interesting. So wait, waking up and thinking that he was a cockroach, or being like, that's fascinating.
I you know, honestly, I haven't read that book, but it's a story about waking up with the perception that he's a cockroach. And the whole story is about him being a cockroach and how he saw the world, I guess. Hmm. Maybe Andrea knows much better than me. No, she doesn't. Okay.
That's interesting. That's really interesting to think about.
You guys want to know what the definition says?
Yeah.
It says characteristic. Well, hang on a second. There's two different ones. So let me use this one. It says it's used to describe situations that are disorienting and illogically complex in a surreal or nightmarish way.
That would be a nightmare.
Yeah. Being a cockroach. Thank you, Cheryl. That's really helpful. I appreciate you looking that up. Excellent.
What was the word again?
Kafkaesque. Did I get it right that time, Andrea? Yeah, okay. Kafkaesque. It was on page 1846.
It's because he writes with such an ironic... all his pieces are really dark and weird and ironic. Metaphors and things like that. So, and yeah, it does include the story about the cockroach. I've read it. I don't remember that much about it, but that is the right person.
I might look that up. Name. It sounds like, what are those, like Grimm's fairy tales that are kind of dark and like, you know, I don't know, not necessarily something you want to read right before bed, but I might Google that and see if I can find it right before bed. So
in the philosophical side of,
I see. Got it. Thank you. Alrighty, let's keep reading. So I'm at the top, I guess the second full paragraph on the top of page 1848. Second full paragraph. So this is the prior paragraph just ended with the sentence, a particularly important message emerges for Helen's life, one that we will try to elucidate now. Helen is living on a battleground. Aren't we all? She is to some degree locked in combat with all her brothers. She entered the war hoping to gain the spoils. As Jesus says, perhaps you think the battleground can offer something that you can win. Yet the cost is so great that now she wants to call a truce. She chooses to retain her impulse to attack, for she still hopes to one day win the war. But at this point, she is seeking a compromise. So she conceals her hatred behind a display of love, which she hopes will placate the enemy enough for him to agree to a ceasefire. This may seem like a solution, but is it really? Jesus observes, no one compromises with an enemy, but hates him still for what he kept from him. Mistake not truce for peace, nor compromise for escape from conflict. Indeed, this, quote, solution puts Helen precisely in the situation of the blue-gray bird. Now we see that the bird's split allegiance between the blues and the grays is really Helen's split allegiance between love and attack, and that is definitely for all of us. It's an interpersonal issue. Helen can't decide what to do with her brothers. Will she love them or murder them? This is what roots her to the battleground. This is why the bird can't imagine leaving the tree. But as Jesus notes, there is no place of safety in the battleground. The idea that a barren, rotting, tilting tree will provide real shelter is ludicrous. This, however, only begins to capture the desperation of Helen's situation. The section offers a penetrating analysis of the strategy of mixing love and attack. We think of love as meeting the needs of the other person and attack as serving our own needs. Since most of us want to honor both sets of needs, we hang on to both love and attack. We creatively mix them together to create a hybrid of the two, and this hybrid becomes the primary means through which we relate to the world. Yet the hybrid tends to be made of the content of the attack while merely having the form of love. The section captures this strange amalgam with stark images. It speaks of someone justifying his savagery with smiles as he attacks, putting on a friendly smile to make his attack appear kind. And it speaks of giving someone a beautifully wrapped box with no gift inside. Quote, the wrapping does not make the gift you give. An empty box, however beautiful and gently given, still contains nothing. The loving facade is designed, of course, to conceal our attacking intent from others. Yet perhaps surprisingly, it is also designed to conceal our attack from ourselves. Our attack disturbs us, and we try to hide it even from our own eyes. For the truth is that attack does not serve our needs. It does not get us anything we really want. Instead, it leaves us with a heavy load of guilt on our shoulders, along with a constant fear of punishment. And I'll just read this, then we'll pause. Attack in any form, and that's italicized, attack in any form is equally destructive. Its purpose does not change. Its sole intent is murder, and what form murder serves to cover the massive and what form of murder serves to cover the massive guilt and frantic fear of punishment the murderer must feel? I'll just pause here for a few moments. And what I feel moved to just share is that this is why we need absolute radical honesty, absolute, complete, transparent honesty with the Holy Spirit. I've heard and used the phrase outing your ego. It's like even if you're not going to admit it to anybody else, writing it out in a journal, saying it to spirit, admitting it to yourself, because that ego, that attack, it wants to hide. It wants to, as it says, be masked with a smile. And I'm sure we've all had experiences of both saying or being on the receiving end of something that sounds maybe like an apology, or sounds nice, but there's like a sub message, you know, underneath the words. We've probably all done that at some point and been on the receiving end of that point, of that example, excuse me. And so that's why honesty with Holy Spirit is so important, because what comes to mind for me right now is the definition of when A Course in Miracles is talking about honesty. It says that nothing that you think or say or do is out of alignment. It says that the term actually means consistency. There's alignment between all those things, what we think, what we say, and what we do. And if we're out of alignment in any one of those areas, the best thing we can do is, number one, not beat ourselves up and not hide it, but get honest about it. Call our ego out and say, Holy Spirit, I recognize that I'm judging or attacking or, you know, whatever that may be. That's the best thing that we can do. And that's not to increase shame or guilt. It's actually to see clearly the ego mind at work, to not personalize it, but to recognize that it's not who we truly are. And the only way through it And the only way to undo it is by seeing it truly and honestly and without any defenses. That's a big one. I'll keep reading, but does anybody have anything that you'd like to chime in with? Dee.
Yeah, this cameo to me is such a great illustration of where the text talks about the fate, where the face of innocence.
Mm-hmm. That's such a good reading. Yes.
Yeah.
Do you want to say more?
No, just one of my favorite cameos because it really explains it. It really shows what that looks like it in really ourselves. Does.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for that. That's a great thing for anybody who wants to read more about that to look up the face of innocence. And I remember reading that in the group. I don't know how long ago it was or what chapter it's in. But thank you, Dee, for making that connection for us. I appreciate it. Andrea.
I'm noticing in this cameo that my biggest battlefield, at least right now, is attacking my own body and my own, like the battlefield for me is not liking the fact that I've put on, you know, 20 extra pounds because of COVID and my clothes don't fit. And so I kind of like attack my own body, and my struggle is not seeing myself as a body and still holding on to the attack. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not leaving the tree.
Right. Right. That image of not leaving the tree is pretty powerful. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And I'm sure, 100% sure that you are not alone in that. And you're making just a really important point that the battleground doesn't have to be out there. It can be very much internal, whether it's toward our bodies, whether it's toward, like with anxiety, maybe an aspect of our minds. That we can pick any place. The ego will accept any battleground, you know, no matter where it is. And so, being so honest and acknowledging that and talking to Holy Spirit about it is the best thing to do. So thank you, Andrea. I appreciate you sharing that. Anybody else want to add to anything that's been said or have a question or a reflection before we continue? You know, I guess I just want to add to Andrea's comment just then, because we're so identified with these bodies and it is such a tempting place, you know, to harbor attack for both. It takes me back to just all of my reading and training. I was a women's studies minor and looking at advertising and how women are portrayed in the media and men too, and how, you know, there is an ideal that we are shown out there and very, very small percentage of the population measures up to that. And that just all that came up for me too, and just how important it is that we recognize when we're feeling like that battleground is within. I actually just noticed two comments. Nikki, I'm not sure. So will the reading expand or not on feeling safe as it goes on? I'm not sure exactly. I don't know that it will, but you'll have to let me know. I'm not exactly sure what you're commenting on in terms of, like, you know, what part of the reading. So if you want to add more in there.
Hi, Corinne.
Oh, hi, Nikki.
There was like one little line about safety or feeling safe or moving safely. And I was like, oh, good. I was tuned in for that. My antennas were up. But then I didn't know if it was going to talk further about it.
Like moving safely through the battleground?
I can't remember the exact wording.
Okay, gotcha. Well, the Holy Spirit is our safety, right? So wherever the attack, wherever the battleground seems to be, whether it's internally taken out on our bodies, our minds, whether it's a relationship or a situation out there, the Holy Spirit is our safety and our guide, you know, out of the battleground. So that's really, that's what comes up strongly for me in thinking about moving through the battleground, because the again, just intellectualizing that, hey, I want to just rise above the battleground and just having it stop there is not actually going to lift us out of the battleground. It's the Holy Spirit almost, I almost think of it as like, first of all, it can happen in an instant where we do feel like we're lifted up above. It can also be that with the Holy Spirit, we navigate our way through the battleground, interacting, you know, with those who may trigger us or those situations that may trigger us in order to show us what it is that we need to see. But I just found with that constant willingness, with that willingness to be honest with Holy Spirit and withhold nothing, that you're giving Spirit, it's as if you're like, it's as if the battleground almost like opens up, like parts of a path becomes made for you through which you have lessons that you can go through to find your way out. But it's always with the Holy Spirit. So that just comes up for me, Nikki.
Thank you.
Where our safety is. Thank you. Hi, Fanny. I'm seeing your chat. So the topics are in the truth of God, unconditional love. How I know it's the truth. Do you have to? So, okay, this is a great question that I'll just touch upon. The question from Fanny, thank you so much for asking this. The question is that the truth of God is unconditional love and that God did not create this world. How does one know this? Like, do you have to experience it to know it, or do you just sort of know it? Well, that's, I feel like, what the workbook lessons are guiding us to have an experience of. But until we do, it's like, we have the words to read on the page. It can be to some degree, you know, just known up in our heads because of the words, but it is ultimately an experience that really teaches us. It's through getting glimpses. I like to think of truth coming through as glimpses here and there. And it's like those glimpses are all little pebbles that start to add up, that maybe not even pebbles, maybe more like stones. It's as if a new foundation becomes built in our minds. And it's a foundation that's based on the truth rather than, you know, on the ego. So I do think that it is something that you can, that is most known through experience. But until then, you know, that's why we have the workbook and that's why we have the words on the page. So thank you, Fanny. That was a great question. Alrighty. And I see lots of thank yous in the chat also to you, Andrea, for sharing. Dave.
to Fanny's question, something that's really kind of helped me turn my perspective around, not that I'm totally there yet or anything, but just the first, you know, 20 workbook lessons show you more clearly, step by step, how the world outside really is nothing, absolutely nothing, but your projection of your own perception onto it. And it's really nothing more than that. This, the world has no meaning other than what we give it. And I don't know, when I start thinking in those terms, I think that, what does it matter if it's physical? Well, it's not even really physical. It's mental, and I guess that helps me see it in a mental framework rather than a physical framework, as something being outside of myself. So I don't know if that's helpful or not, but it was to me.
Thank you, Dave. You know, it's, what's interesting to me is what is helpful to us depending on where we are in our journey. Because I know at one point in my journey, when my anxiety was so bad, it was a lot of the intellectual stuff that was really helpful to me, because I was all up in my head, you know, with the anxiety. I mean, I experienced the anxiety very much in my body, but it was the words on the page. It was all the lessons, you know, that were really helpful to me. And now I'm finding that my current learning is very, for lack of a better word, more embodied, meaning in my body, like sensing things in my body, feeling guidance in my body, feeling, noticing how, you know, the sensation of fear that shows up. And so being able to sort of, I don't know how to put it into words, except that it's moved me, my current place where I am is much more grounded in the body than it ever was before. And neither are wrong. They're both, you know, we are in bodies. We do believe that we're in them here. And so it's like we need both. And in my own journey, I've just found at different times, you know, one thing's more helpful than another, and it sort of flows. But that's the beauty of when we hand it over to the Holy Spirit, is that we'll be given the help that we need. So thank you for that, Dave, and thank you, Fanny. Oh, anybody else? Paula, are you going to share?
No. What Dave was just saying, I'm becoming much more aware of, and I don't like it because it places so much responsibility on me.
That's honest.
And I think that's one of the reasons why we really would rather just project all of our nonsense out on the world.
Right.
Because when you stop doing that, whoa.
Right. Yeah, and it's just a reminder too, though, like all the nonsense out there has got to be coming from me. So just like you're saying, Paula, like if I'm responsible, I don't like that. So
I'm not so sure about that, but no, there is freedom in that.
Yes, that's where I was going. There's absolutely freedom in that. There's big freedom in that, because that means rather than saying like, oh, the world is this crazy, insane place and I'm going to just turn away from it. What are we doing? But now we're not looking at our mirror anymore, right? We're not looking at what is in our mind. And so instead, by turning toward it and saying, hey, if I'm 100% responsible, I don't know, that makes no sense. I don't know how, but I'm willing still to own that, or I'm willing to try that on. Holy Spirit, show me.
Yeah.
And it's the show me piece that for me shows me. And
that's always the answer right there. Holy Spirit, help me out with this. Just help me out with this, because that's where the clarity really comes in, you know? And without the Holy Spirit, I don't know. I'm just adrift.
Yeah, we all are. And that's why we need the Holy Spirit. And that's why I'm so grateful. The Holy Spirit is never... I've switched to she, is here right now with all of us, in every single one of us.
And always available. Sometimes I honestly question that, like, how is this possible that you could even tolerate listening to me for one more minute when I get into these, into a snit.
But that's the Holy Spirit. I mean, were you referring to the Holy Spirit listening to you?
Yes. Because when you really start to take it all and turn it over, it's like, how is anything so endlessly patient?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And
we
forgiving.
Can't conceive of it. That points right there. Us, you know, my inability to conceive of that points to the fact that, like, hey, I must have some beliefs in my mind that are trying to reinforce something else. And that's where I need to look. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Paula.
You're welcome.
Jason, were you going to share?
I just wanted to say something about addressing what Paula was talking about about patience. Mm-hmm. And I actually restarted the lessons after going through 1 through 50. Because I wanted to do it with the book, and David Hoffmeister has every lesson with a little bit of reading and then the lesson and some commentary. And what became really clear to me was that we're perceiving time and space, but the Holy Spirit is outside of time and space. There's no need for patience because there's no time.
Ooh, that's one of those, like, I don't know how to describe it, but like those mind straightening, that thought brings your mind back into right-mindedness.
The only reality every spiritual teacher I've ever heard, including Eckhart Tolle, Ramana Maharshi, Rupert Spira, Course in Miracles, is the present moment. Mm-hmm. Your whole life is the present moment. So you should pay attention. You should probably pay attention to the present moment.
Which extends to infinity. Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you, Jason, for that beautiful reminder about the present moment, because that's again, like the ego can only exist with the idea of a past or a future. If it was just, you know, in the, you know what, here's another mind-bending thought. We're not even like seeing the present. This is all done already. This is all, as the course says, you're mentally reviewing that which has already happened. And yet, obviously, we're perceiving here, we're in bodies. So the best thing that we can do is to get into the present, because that's where the Holy Spirit is, that's where eternity is. And it's in the present that we, you know, hear guidance and can tune in and experience miracles. That's where miracles live too, in the now. So thank you for that, Jason. It's a really, really important reminder. All right, so we have a couple of pages, we have like 2.5 pages left. So I definitely want to get us through this reading for the night. So let's dive in. Thank you everybody so much for your comments and your shares. I always am so grateful and appreciative of everything that you add. So we're at mid page 1849, right in the middle. We are hoping that if we put a kindly face on our attacks, we ourselves will be blind to them and thus manage to protect ourselves from their crushing burden of guilt. Yet Jesus says that this strategy utterly fails, for in the end, we cannot avoid the real intent behind our actions. And this is a quote from the Course. He may deny he is a murderer and justify his savagery with smiles as he attacks. Yet he will suffer and will look on his intent in nightmares, where the smiles are gone and where the purpose rises to meet his horrified awareness and to pursue him still. For no one thinks of murder and escapes the guilt the thought entails. If the intent is death, what matter the form it takes? The commentary continues, all we accomplish through this strategy is to conceal from ourselves the real source of our pain. We still feel the pain inherent in being an attacker. We just have no idea where it comes from. Jesus's logic here is undeniable. Quote, if it is true, attack in any form will hurt you and will do so just as much as in another form, which you do recognize, then it must follow that you do not always recognize the source of pain. So Helen's problem goes beyond being stuck in an outer environment filled with conflict. She is also stuck in an inner environment pervaded by guilt and fear, while being clueless as to where these feelings come from. This actually gives new meaning to the symbolism of the tree. Right after saying, "Not one tree left standing still will shelter you," Jesus asks these pointed questions. Think you the form that murder takes can offer safety? Can guilt be absent from a battlefield? Notice how this implies that the form that murder takes is the same thing as the one tree left standing. For both are described as failing to offer the safety that we seek in them. This implies that the dead tree now symbolizes the phony smile, the nice facade with which Helen attempts to cover up her murderous intent. And by the way, this is for all of us, obviously, not just Helen. She hopes this flimsy covering will serve as a shield to protect her from her own attacks. But it's just like the rickety tree. It offers no protection whatsoever. What is her way out? The answer in both her dream and the section is the same: to rise above the battleground. And since staying on the battleground stems from an interpersonal stance, rising above it is also an interpersonal decision. She needs to realize that being loving is not only for the sake of others. Rather, being loving is her own need, indeed, her only need. She thus needs to understand that any attack on her part, no matter how carefully disguised, is an attack on her own peace. As Jesus put it, this is your part, to realize that murder in any form is not your will. On a practical level, this first means learning to recognize her attacks, even the most artfully camouflaged ones. As we said before, this is like outing your ego. She can do this not by scrutinizing the outer forms, but by being very sensitive to her feelings. Quote, even in forms you do not recognize, the signs you know. There is a stab of pain, a twinge of guilt, and above all, a loss of peace. Once she spots these signs, her job is to then quickly choose a miracle instead of murder. Choose to extend love rather than deal out death. This decision to resolve her inner split in favor of love is the decision of the blue-gray bird to at last stretch out its wings and lift off from the tree. He no longer has any use for the battleground, and so he does not choose to be there. Rising above it, he will finally be safe from all its deafening violence. As he circles higher, the ground of battle will seem increasingly remote and insignificant, as his world becomes instead the lofty sphere in which he now soars. He will forget about the clash of forms as he turns his attention to basking in the endless sunshine of his father's love. In the light of this supreme joy, he will wonder how he could have wasted even a minute on that hopeless battlefield. I want to pause here for a moment. I know we only have a few minutes left and we'll definitely finish this up. But I just want to comment on a few things before I lose my thoughts. And let me just see first if I can retrieve them. I guess I just want to reemphasize again how this to me again is saying the importance of that radical honesty, that importance of outing our ego, to recognize that even the tiniest stab of pain, a twinge of guilt, above all, a loss of peace, all those are red flags. They're like markers that when they show up in our experience, we have an opportunity to choose again. And one of the best prayers, we know it's page 90, right, Paula? And 229 in the CE, it's that prayer, I must have decided wrongly because I'm not at peace. And it's just a really helpful reset. Faden, did you want to contribute?
Yes, one of the sentences that just really jumps out at me is on 150 towards the bottom. Once she spots the signs that he's talked about, her job is then to quickly choose a miracle instead of murder. Choose to extend love rather than deal with death. And isn't that kind of everything? I mean, if you could put the Course in Miracles in one little...
sentence, that's it. Yeah, I really like that you're putting it that way, because that is, I agree with you. That's like putting
it's a miracle instead of murder or whatever.
Right. And how do we do that though? Right. How do we choose that miracle? This is for me where my mind goes. I don't know how. I don't know how to do anything, but I can turn to the Holy Spirit who knows how to choose for me. And that three letter word for is all throughout the course. And I overlooked it for years. There's, even in that page 90, page 229 prayer, I don't know if I'll ever remember it. I now have it on a post-it right above my computer. The Holy Spirit will undo the consequences. It says something at the end about choosing for God for me. So that word for me, Holy Spirit will do it for me. It says that over and over and over throughout the course. Our part is so little. Mm-hmm. Our part is so little. It's to choose the Holy Spirit. As Jason said, it's in this moment. We choose for the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit does whatever the Holy Spirit does. And we are open, you know, to extending that miracle. And we talked about this a couple weeks ago about what miracle impulses are. They're those bursts of love that come up. And it might be, I mean, I remember having it once in the car. I had a burst of love to call a family member. And then my head was like, no, if you call, you know, they're going to do X, Y, and Z, and you don't want to, you know, have to deal with that. And so it's like, we, the ego, it's like whack-a-mole, right? It's trying to whack down those miracle impulses that are wanting to constantly pop up. And so if we notice that impulse arise in us to extend love, we can calm the Holy Spirit and stand in that place of strength to not side with the ego who's going to want to, you know, tamp down those love impulses coming up. So for me, that's what choosing a miracle is. It's choosing for the Holy Spirit to do it for me. So Faden, thank you for making that highlight of that beautiful sentence. I agree with you. It encapsulates the course perfectly. Ah, and I think that was actually around the area that I wanted to comment on. So I think I feel the only thing I'll just emphasize again that I have written here in pencil is that rising above the battleground, it's almost like what we just talked about with miracles, as those miracles extend through us, as we choose the Holy Spirit chooses love for us. That is what like rises us above the battleground. That is the literal, it's almost like that updraft of love that carries us up above the battleground. It's not from Corinne saying, oh, I don't want to watch that on the news because that's upsetting, or I can't. That's not how I rise above the battleground. I rise above the battleground by being in guidance, to get involved in whatever it is that I'm being called to step into, to speak up with. I turn to the Holy Spirit. I feel those impulses of love, you know, come through. Sometimes love says no, you know, Marianne Williams had said that. So whatever it is that we are moved to extend through guidance, and it's that updraft of love of the Holy Spirit that lifts us above the battleground. Yay. All right, we ready to keep reading? I think we'll finish out this section right now. So we're at the top of page 1851. We have now seen the original dream, as well as two references to it in the dictation of A Course in Miracles. This gives us a chance to step back and try to see exactly what Jesus is accomplishing with those references. What Helen's original dream does is provide her with a memorable story filled with vivid imagery that depicts a key pattern of hers and ours. The pattern is her propensity to be split between two opposing sides, like two canoes, like we talked about before, which leaves her stuck in an inhospitable environment, which she instead could simply leave. The dream's absurdity is a powerful communicator of the pattern's manifest insanity. Then, in 1965, when Jesus begins dictating the course to her, he references this dream during his teaching on confusing miracle impulses and sexual impulses. Then in 1967, our main focus here, he references the dream again while teaching about mixing love and attack. Each time he does, he brings the power of that story forward into his current teaching, using the dream as a kind of visual illustration to the point he is making. At the same time, his current teaching also flows backward into the dream, imbuing its enigmatic symbols with a rich and specific content. Trying to be both blue and gray becomes an interpersonal stance of trying to extend both love and lust, or both love and attack. The battleground becomes the conflict-ridden nature of this world, as well as the guilt-ridden condition of Helen's mind. And the tree becomes Helen's futile attempt to take cover behind a loving facade that will supposedly protect her from guilt. Thus, at the same time that his current teaching is strengthened by having the dream, there as a kind of parable, the dream itself acquires a detailed, sophisticated, and genuinely practical meaning. As a result, the dream becomes a refrain that runs through Helen's life. Each time it reappears, the new teaching in which it is embedded, which may seem weird and irrelevant, is shown to be merely another chapter in the ongoing thread of guidance about this pattern of hers and ours. Meanwhile, this thread grows ever richer as new colors are woven into it each time it returns. The presence of this continuing thread proves to Helen the compelling constancy of the messages she is receiving over the course of her life. And this constancy reminds her that she cannot avoid her pattern forever, that eventually She must face and rise above her attachment to the battleground. I want to invite and just see if anybody has any closing thoughts, but I'll just close with this last sentence. And this constancy reminds her that she cannot avoid her pattern forever, that eventually she must face and rise above her attachment to the battleground. So we can't avoid the truth. I mean, we can't avoid the truth. It's here. We can only think that we can avoid it. And whatever patterns that we have in our lives that perhaps are a block to love or extending love to ourselves or toward others, it's a reminder that there will come a time, maybe it's now, maybe we've been doing this type of work where instead of turning away from it, we turn towards, we lean into it with the Holy Spirit and say, hey, I'm willing to look deeply at this because I don't want this anymore. I don't want what it brings. Cheryl, thank you so much. Let's not forget that God also gave us forgiveness as a key to unlock the door to peace. Absolutely. You know, forgiveness to me and choosing love and a mirror, like, I know they're different words and they mean different things, but I've shared this before that forgiveness is like the process of forgiving. It's for the giving to the Holy Spirit. So I am so grateful, Cheryl, that you highlighted that that word, because I mean, that's what we're talking about for sure. This whole thing is about forgiveness. So it's forgiving ourselves, forgiving others, being willing to forgive, because that's also, I'm sorry, I'm going on a tangent, but I feel like Corinne doesn't know how to forgive. So again, I choose for the Holy Spirit, who does know how to, you know, make that happen. And that's, you know, that's the process. At least that's been helpful for me to think of it that way. So thank you, Cheryl. Let's see. And just lots of, lots of thank yous from people. Anybody want to, Tracy?
I just wanted to share real quick with you guys. This book, it's called Trust Your Truth by Shannon Algio. It's just so crazy because you're talking about radical honesty and he's on the same path. He's got course quotes in here. Awesome teacher, has a podcast called Soul Feed.
Uh-huh.
But it's all about looking honestly and with love with everything that needs to be healed and our connectedness and owning our power and connecting our connection to source and Holy Spirit, whatever you want to call it. But I just want to share that because it's just so funny because the whole cameo kind of wove into it. And
That's awesome. Oh, cool. Thank you, Tracy. Thank you. I always enjoy book recommendations. Thank you so much. Oh, any other comments? Questions, final thoughts, Jason.
Just something about forgiveness that I'm very new to this course. So I'm on chapter 3. Mm-hmm. And one thing that stood out to me about forgiveness, and involves space and time again, by forgiving the past, you release the future. Mm-hmm. I thought that was just really incredible. I don't know what it is about that statement, but otherwise the future is just a reflection of the past.
Right, right. We keep, what's the expression? Like history repeating itself and the past continuing to repeat itself until we, you know, look and lean into and forgive.
Isn't it the definition of insanity?
Right.
doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results.
Right, absolutely. Really,
what Jason's saying releases that nonsense. The future is wide open.
Absolutely. And forgiveness is that release. And the Holy Spirit is involved in the process. So thank you for that. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much, Cheryl, for adding that to the discussion. I love you all. Thank you so much for being here. And we will continue. I don't know how exciting iambic pentameter will be. I don't know if I've actually read this cameo before, but that's the next one on the list. And thanks everyone. And for all of you for sharing. I love you all. And
I'll see you next week. Good night.
Good night, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. I sell your heart, hands, Wendy. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.